Well, hello, I'm Kishania Carnegie and welcome to Raising Love Consciousness. On this Monday, November the 15th, 2010, in the US of A, and Tuesday the 16th here in Australia. Now, because I could spend hours and hours speaking with our guest today, and we don't have hours and hours, before I introduce him, and whilst we wait for a few more latecomers, I just want to take a few minutes to talk about something that hopefully will make the diversity of the topics we'll cover today a little easier to understand in the time that we do have available, and as I should also add, for the non-scientist people on the call, we have a lot of people who do have a scientific background, but we also have a lot of people who don't, who have a humanities background. So I want to just highlight the difference between linear thinking and systems thinking in its simplest and most basic form. And before your eyes start to glaze over, just hang on and stay with me for a minute, because systems thinking is something that you're very familiar with already. It's a skill that you were born with, but the school system probably drummed it out of you. And so it just might need to be brought to the forefront of your thinking, because a conscious awareness of what thinking is, systems thinking is all about, is one of the major keys to raising our spiritual love consciousness, to thinking and acting at higher levels of consciousness. And when I talk about thinking in systems, we've all heard of systems such as our circulatory system, which is how our blood flows around our bodies, and our respiratory system, which, if we think about it properly, is how we breathe in oxygen from the trees. That oxygen, and this is a very simplistic explanation, of course, breathe in oxygen from the trees. That oxygen helps to sustain our blood system, our circulatory system, and keep it healthy. And then we breathe out carbon dioxide so that the trees are able to breathe that in and stay alive too. I mean, nature is just so beautiful in the way it does things. And that's because everything is interconnected. Everything is related to everything else, and so everything impacts on everything else. And that includes how nature works. I'm sure you've heard of ecosystems, and that's looking at, you know, different parts of nature and how it all interacts and works together to live in harmony and be healthy. And even your personal relationships work in exactly the same way. Everything is interconnected, and so everything impacts on everything else. And many of our Raising Love Consciousness family members are natural healers in one form or another, and natural healers are often referred to as holistic healers because they always treat the whole system. They take a big picture approach to their patients' concerns. Now, unlike most, well, not necessarily all, but most medical doctors, who, instead of looking at the whole system, will take a narrow, linear look at the presenting problem, whatever that might be. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, problem and treatment, and 5 or 10 minutes later you're out the door with a prescription in your hand. So thinking linearly, whenever I can say it, is like reading a book. For most people anyway. You start on page one, you continue through the pages sequentially and end up on the last page of the book. A linear activity. You're going in a straight line. Whereas using the internet is a holistic, systemic activity. There's no beginning, no end to the internet. You can enter the internet at any point or any site, or for that matter, Google can send you to any page on any site. And from that page, you can link to another related page or site, and from that site or page you can link to yet another one, and so on. And the only two things giving you a beginning and an end when you're on the internet are where you specifically choose to enter, and that's not the first page of the internet, like the first page of a book. It's just your choice for a place to enter. And the other thing, of course, is the time you have available, and that will dictate when and so where you leave or end that session. So the internet system is like all cyclical things, the chicken and the egg, a circle. There's no official beginning point and no official end point. Again, everything is interconnected, everything is related to everything else, and everything impacts on everything else. So apart from the fact that I believe a basic awareness of systems thinking is essential to everyone on this planet who has a desire to continually evolve, the reason I wanted to explain all of that is because our guest today, Dr. Paul LaViolette, did his doctoral research, his PhD, in systems science. And what that means is that instead of just focusing narrowly on his topic, he took a big picture approach to find out the answers he was seeking. Now, by contrast, most scientists, if they're interested in as an example, a fly, all they will do is to study and become an expert on the fly's eyelash, if indeed flies do have eyelashes. I don't know. Maybe they do, but I don't think they do. But maybe they would study why a fly doesn't have an eyelash. But it was by taking a systems approach to his research that Dr. LaViolette, who was a physicist, came to link such seemingly incredibly diverse topics as tarot cards, zodiac, the Sphinx, to what's happening in the center of our galaxy. And before we find out how he did that, just let me share with you a little more about Dr. LaViolette. As I mentioned, he's a physicist, and because of the systems approach he took to his doctoral research, he's also studied astrology, tarot, cosmology, Egyptology, cryptology, to name a few of the ologies he's researched. Dr. LaViolette was the first person to make many cosmological predictions, which have subsequently been confirmed by hard scientific data. And one such prediction was that high-intensity volleys of cosmic ray particles travel directly to our planet from distant sources in our galaxy. Now, all that from a bloke who likes tarot cards. It's wonderful. And he's the co-developer of a theory which explains how brain-mind forms, the brain-mind connection forms creative thoughts. He developed the theory of sub-quantum kinetics, discovered the concept of galactic superwaves, and is the founder of the Starburst Foundation, which is dedicated to researching or continuing the research into all of these areas. And as I said on my website, I could go on and on, but instead I'll just say, Dr. Paul LaViolette, welcome to Raising Love Consciousness. It's just wonderful to have you here.
Hello. Very happy to be here on your show.
Right. Now, Paul, as I mentioned actually before we got started, there are several areas that I want to cover, which are, of course, all interconnected. But I want to start with the Zodiac, Sphinx, and the Tarot, and then move on to the very important topic of our galactic center and what's going on there. And then I have a number of current day questions that's going on at the moment, both questions of mine and also questions that people have written in. So let's start here with what makes a physicist who's interested in cosmology turn to the Sphinx, the Zodiac and tarot cards over 30 years ago to find out what's happening in the center of the galaxy?
Well, being a systems scientist, I guess that's the answer.
What on earth made you think, hey, the tarot cards will show me what's going on in the center of the galaxy? You could have sort of said Mars will show me what's going on, but why specifically the Zodiac tarot cards?
Yeah, it was actually the connection to the physics that I was developing. It was later that I saw the connection to the galactic core message. But originally, I was in the process of developing a systems approach to physics. In other words, taking systems concepts which had been applied to other fields of science very successfully, and I was bringing them into physics to sort of do an overhaul of physics. In other words, create a new physics field theory, unified field theory. And it was in the process of doing that, eventually came to call the theory subquantum kinetics, In the process of doing that, I would explain to my friends, I was very excited about this new physics. It was very different from what's taught currently in schools. And one friend I was explaining to said, geez, that sounds a lot like the Tarot. She said, you should take a course on the Tarot. So I went and took a course. This was when I was living in Boston. And in Cambridge, there was a fellow teaching Tarot. And as he taught the meanings of the major arcana, you know, there's 22 major arcana in the Tarot, which are like the picture cards that have been deleted from the modern playing card deck. But the original Tarot deck has 78 cards, which 22 of these are these picture cards. And it is said, and this is what he was saying in his discussion, that the first 11 cards describe the creation of the universe. And as he, in each week, we met every week, was explaining the meanings of one or two of these cards in the order going from 0 to 22.
Did your tarot teacher... did he have the insight that 0 to 11 was the creation of the universe, or was he just explaining the cards and you were able to see the pattern and link it together?
Well, he had no idea about the physics they contained. Neither did any of the occult scholars. All they knew is that at some time in the distant past, the originators of this had claimed that this was a physics contained a physics of the universe, of how the universe was formed. But it's sort of like as if we're left with the summary chapter of the book without the book. You know, there was nobody there to explain how these particular cards did explain the universe, but as he was explaining the concepts, which are really more or less metaphorical concepts, which are used, for example, in fortune-telling, or they're usually described in terms of personalities, people's personalities. Mm-hmm. But I saw that they were really describing universal principles that I had learned in studying systems theory. And in fact, that particular aspect of systems theory that's applicable to creating a theory of physics.
For some reason or other, we had the line drop out.
Happened before in another interview with Mel Fabregas' show. It was cut 27 times. I hope it doesn't happen. We attributed it to. Interference by clandestine operations, this sort of thing. I don't know.
Okay, that's interesting.
I mean, it's really easy to interrupt a this type of call.
Yes. When you say clandestine operations, are you talking about, because I had another speaker, are you aware of the work of Bruce Caffey? He's,
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit. I haven't read his books, but I heard
but you
him
know
speak
his
one.
Name.
Yeah.
I spoke to him at the beginning of the year, or early in the year anyway, and he has had a lot of strange things happen in his life, preventing him from getting his information out. Now, when you say from clandestine things, are you referring to those sort of clandestine things that people might be stopping you from getting your information out?
Trying to scare me or something. I don't know what the reason was, but it was just very strange that our conversation be interrupted 27 times.
Exactly, because I have never
That was not live, so they could all be edited out.
Mm. Yeah, but I've done about 50 of these interviews. And I have never had my phone line drop out before, or never had the phone line drop out before. So we must treat you with kid gloves, Paul.
I should mention in that previous interview, I was discussing my book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, in which I've sort of disclosed how formally classified technologies work. And so for people trying to keep these classified, it's made a lot of people angry, basically. I have talked to somebody who was fairly high level, with high level clearance. I asked him when there were no minders around, was I on the right track in what I wrote in my book? He was reading the book. He agreed that I was. So.
Well, you see, the anti-propulsion gravity is the sort of thing that Bruce Caffey is into. And so let's not talk about that.
we'll
leave that, and please read Paul's book on anti-propulsion gravity, because like all his books, they are absolutely fantastic, and unless they can get involved in the US mail service and stop it being sent to you, you should be right. Now, you were talking before we were rudely interrupted. You were talking about, and we might move on a little bit, you were talking about the tarot cards, that you were able to see the physics involved in the tarot, and, how it was able to explain the...
What was amazing was that the concepts were explained in the right order, because there's a certain inherent order how you describe this physics, this systems approach to physics. It's basically the idea of how a flux-type system, in other words, an open system, like to give you an example, like a candle. Look at a candle flame, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The flame is a form of order, and it's only there as long as the candle is lit. And the reason it maintains its structure is because there's a flow of wax turning to gas and combusting and creating waste products. So that's what we call an open system, because there's flow. So if you stop the flow, like cut off the oxygen so that the reaction stops, the flame disappears. And that's the basic concept in most systems theory, applications of systems theory, is they're dealing with open systems. The basic idea is that order, an ordered form, is based on a process, an underlying process.
Mm.
And the tarot was explaining this in the right order. It would begin with process. It would explain how that process was organized. Then it would talk about the zero-point fluctuations, that process had fluctuations in it, and how one of those fluctuations would get amplified.
Right.
Fell, and finally would create this wave pattern. And the final, the final card, number 10, was the wave. Which actually would show the wave. You know, that's the one with the Wheel of Fortune, where the two genies, are opposite sides of the wheel, are going from fortune to failure, sort of cyclically.
Mm-hmm.
So what it was really showing was how a wave emerges out of the ether.
Right.
And the wave we're talking about is like a particle of matter, like a proton or neutron.
Mm-hmm. And so from there, obviously that triggered your interest and your thought. Where did the Sphinx and the Zodiac come from? Where did that, subsequently or?
That was during my class that I was taking. The professor was pointing out that a lot of tarotists linked the tarot cards to the zodiac signs. Various occultists had different ways of linking them up. And some of the people in the class had studied astrology, and so I took an interest and started getting some books on astrology. And so I thought, well, maybe astrology also has this physics, because it's also metaphorical. The zodiac signs are describing personality descriptions, and you could look at those as universal principles also. So I started sort of like a game, trying to put the zodiac signs in similar orders the way that Tarot was describing these principles. So you can think of the Tarot as one of the keys, and the zodiac is a cryptogram, and you're trying to decode the cryptogram, because it turns out that the zodiac signs weren't in the proper order. You had to reorder them. And it turns out that the Sphinx is the other key that helps. And it, in fact, the Tarot is referred to as a key. It's called the silver key in esoteric knowledge. Mm-hmm. And astrology is considered the golden key. And what I found was that when I put them in the right order, the zodiac signs, to explain, well, first of all, they did also explain this same physics in a brilliant fashion. I mean, it's sort of like we're dealing not with cavemen. You know, this. I mean, even though this, the Tarot, they say, came from Egypt originally, that it was... that it was an ancient knowledge taught to the priests, that he would indoctrinate the priests into this in the Temple of Osiris. So we're talking about thousands of years B.C. And the conventional view of ancient culture is that they weren't that technologically advanced. But when you see the knowledge that's encoded in the Tarot and in the Zodiac, you realize that whoever did this was very far advanced. There were concepts in there that we've just discovered ourselves in the last 50 years.
I've discovered this with so many of those ancient, metaphors and ancient, especially ancient calculations within the pyramid and things like that, that, you know, they're describing things that we've only just found out about. So were these superhumans that died out in the Great Flood, or were these people from another dimension or another, extraterrestrial type beings?
Well, in my book, Earth Under Fire, Genesis of the Cosmos, these are two books I wrote based around deciphering this knowledge. I give various interpretations. You know, you can choose. Well, perhaps there was an advanced civilization on Earth that was destroyed by a great catastrophe in ancient times, and that they had reached a level that far exceeds what historians normally would expect of, like, caveman man. You know. Or people were very intuitive and they were able to get this knowledge from higher levels through ESP, telepathy, connection with the supreme beings, you know. The thing is that, in general, I felt personally that it would have been difficult to create such a organized science that was so, it's like put together like a Swiss watch, this Tarot and cipher, that somehow, what in channeling, it's not just not that way. And it's a very imprecise way of gaining knowledge if we take our own experience. The third is that it's off-planet. That was developed by other civilizations and brought here and taught to us, which accords with the ancient myth. And Egyptian myth talks about their knowledge being taught to them by a god, Thoth, who came from above. So I tend to lean towards that. I mean, because, if you read my third book, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, you see that these are actual signals being sent from other parts of the galaxy. Some of them are creating a message, and you come to realize the galaxy is populated by very intelligent civilization it's able to travel. So the possibility that they would come here and teach us this is quite possible.
Yeah. And without, because I'm terrified they're going to cut you off again, without going into too much detail, it would, in your book, Anti-Gravity Propulsion, it would explain how they could do this, because my understanding of anti-gravity propulsion is that you don't have to worry about light years. You know, you can go from A to B in a flash. Is that in a very simple
way?
Yeah,
anti-gravity is not a good word. That was one that was picked by the publisher. I would tend to use the word electrogravitics or field propulsion. They're a technology which current physics considers impossible. It's sort of like what we consider as possible is sort of defined by what is taught in the universities. And the current view is special relativity is correct, which it isn't, you know. And once you can break out of that cage, if you can create a new alternate physics, which is what subquantum kinetics is, it's an alternate physics that pretty much puts to shame standard physics. I mean, it's so far had 11 predictions that have been confirmed. And even stuff that NASA was talking about today that was puzzling their scientists is easily understandable in subquantum kinetics.
And when you say today, this is the news conference that NASA had on the Chandra X-ray images. Mm. While we're talking about that, What were they saying on the Chandra X-ray or the X-ray from the observatory?
Well, I tried to listen to it and couldn't get the their website to work. You'd think they've gone to the moon, but they still haven't figured out that their site can get overloaded and people can't view the conference.
Of course,
I have a Mac. I use a Mac, so that didn't help, I suppose. So they're probably more compatible with PCs. But I did hear the last 3 minutes. My sister listened to it, and I put it next to the phone so I could hear the last 3 minutes of the conference. So I gathered from what they were talking about that they're talking about this discovery of a young, what they call black hole in a galaxy that's close to us. Well, it's 50 million years away. They consider that close. Basically, there was a supernova that went off 31 years ago, 1979. And the last 10 years, they've been observing this source at the center that's putting out a lot of X-ray radiation. And they're calling it a black hole for lack of a better word. Well, their theories expect that an exploding star could form a black hole, so that's why they call it that. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a fan of black holes. I don't believe they exist, and the physics I've developed says it's impossible for them to be created for two reasons. One is that to form a black hole, you need the gravity field within each subatomic particle has to go to infinity to form a singularity, and that's not the case. We know that's not the case from particle scattering experiments, at least as far as the electric field goes. And the electric and gravity field are coupled. So that means that there should be no singularities and that black holes should not form. The other is that when a star collapses, there's a generation of energy within its interior that standard physics doesn't know about, and that's something that's predicted by subquantum kinetics, a prediction which has been verified three or four different ways, so its existence is pretty well established. And the term I use for that energy is called genic energy. It's spontaneously created out of nowhere, basically. It's a violation of the first law of thermodynamics. And actually we're talking about a violation that's so small it can't be observed in a laboratory. But when you apply it to, at the astrophysical level, things like this, it can basically create all the energy observing from this black hole. What they're seeing...
I was just going to say, go on, finish what you were going to say, is what they're saying.
Yeah, well, it's not really a black hole. It's a core of a star. In other words, the star that exploded, they say it was around 20 times the mass of our sun. And a star that size, let's say the mass of the core is about 25% or 30%. So let's say it was around six times the mass of the star, the core that was left after the explosion. Mm-hmm. Now, standard theory says that should have collapsed to form a black hole. Subquantum kinetics says, no, it should stay as a stellar core that's extremely energetic. And that's exactly what they're seeing. They're seeing this energetic source. And they're puzzled that why it's so steady, why the emission is so steady. In fact, they were questioning the whole idea that if it was a black hole, it would have to accrete matter from its surroundings. And that raises two problems. It's blown all the matter away from it. I mean, it had a supernova explosion just 31 years ago. So it pretty much cleared everything away, you know. Mm. And it's putting out so much energy. It's like 160,000 times the energy of that the sun radiates. Mm. That's 16 times more than the most luminous star. And the reason is that a star, if it was that luminous, wouldn't hold its atmosphere.
Yeah.
So anything around it is getting blown the heck away from it. There's no way that matter can fall into it. And if it did, like it would have to form, fall in the form of like a star or a clump, like a comet or something. And if that was the case, it should create a burst of energy, and yet they don't see that. It's like a steady output, just like a star would be. All that can be explained if you just admit one simple thing, that energy conservation is not true. That is a very small violation of energy conservation.
Which is the first law of thermodynamics. So
right. We're talking about a violation that's 10 orders of magnitude smaller than what you can see in the laboratory. In other words, the first law applies well for explaining the refrigerator in your house, but beyond that, you should not canonize it, which is what physicists have done. They've turned it into like a religious canon,
law. They turned it into a law many, many years ago, and surely, and this is something that I just don't understand, surely they should be open-minded enough to say, well, hang on a minute, we've progressed a little further than the law that we put in place, 50 or 100 years ago or something. Why aren't they open? They're open to so many new things. Why aren't they open? And the same, I saw a physicist, a standard normal, with respect to normal physicist, interviewed recently about quantum physics, and he said quantum physics cannot be real because it can't be proven. Anything that can't be seen and proven in a laboratory can't be real. Now, that to me is a stupid thing to say, because we've progressed. Why are they so locked into things like that, into the old way?
Well, physics is in a way like a cult. You create a certain world view, the way you see things, and basically you sweep under the rug any contradictions to your world view. And that's called conversion. That's when you become converted into that view. Mm. So really they're sort of in a little bubble. They're sort of like an altered state of consciousness that we accept as reality, or what they accept as reality, and using the media, they broadcast that throughout the whole world. when you really start looking carefully, you look under the rug, you see all this junk that they put there that completely refutes what they're saying, and you start looking for an alternative, then you're led to alternative views. Like, for example, you realize the Big Bang Theory is a bunch of baloney, and that really the universe isn't expanding. Now, just right there, that shifts everyone's mental outlook on their on the whole universe. You know, I mean, that's got to affect everyone at some level. The idea that all the stars are receding, that eventually the universe will peter out and we'll just have cold embers and sort of the heat death, which some cosmologists talk about, with only black holes gobbling things up. That has to affect people mentally at some level in a very depressing way.
So, for people who want to explore what you've said about the Big Bang, your book, The Genesis or Genesis of the Cosmos, is absolutely fantastic. I can thoroughly recommend it. And we won't go into that Big Bang theory really here once again because of time, because I want to focus on this galactic superwave stuff. But please do buy Genesis of the Cosmos. It's a book that everyone should have and should read, and just give it some thought. Now, Paul, just before we do move on from Genesis of the Cosmos, whilst everyone knows that the Big Bang Theory leaves just as many questions unanswered as it allegedly answers, yet your system's theory of evolution answers all those unanswered questions. Are there other scientists, are you the only scientist in the world who believes your theory, or are there other people who get on board and say, well, hey, Paul, yeah, you got something there?
Yes, various parts of the theory, well, like, for example, a physicist in Greece teaches that, parts of my theory in his class. He's completely impressed with the theory, particularly the part about the energy, spontaneous energy creation, the genic energy, and the continuous matter creation. Also, Nobel laureate Hans
You'll think of it when you're not thinking of it.
The guy who developed the theory of the fusion inside of stars, he reviewed the part about the pioneer effect prediction that the theory had made, and he did acknowledge that it was new, and that he found it interesting, and that it was worthy to be published. So, There are physicists who are fairly even conventional or reputable who have taken to this. I get a lot of emails from people with technical backgrounds that aren't necessarily in academia who love it. They have really terrific credentials.
What can we do, and I mean everyone, what can we all do who also think that what you believe is pretty good, to get it more into the mainstream? What do you do to get something like, you know, other than just academic publications, peer-reviewed publications?
It requires time and persistence to get a new theory across. For example, one fellow told me that for a whole year he was resisting the theory. He read my book, Subquantum Kinetics, and it took him a whole year before it finally clicked and he saw what it was really about. And now he's so excited about it, he's telling all his friends and even professors he can get to look at it. The thing is that when you're rooted in a existing conceptual framework, it takes a long time for you to let go of things that you had never questioned before and be able mm-hmm. to make the jump. You have to think of a theory like a tree, and the physicists or the scientists are like monkeys clinging to the branches, and they're afraid to jump unless there's some place to jump to. And so there's that fear. If I realize that there's something wrong with this branch, I see problems with it, but I have nowhere to jump, so I'm going to continue to hold on, you know. But if there's another theory there, the first thing is for them to be able to understand it fully enough so they see that that's some place they can jump to, and they're not going to make that jump until they see they fully understand that. So it takes time. I guess it did help. I did get some news exposure recently. I did get some news exposure recently, and that would help. It would help if media would start writing some of my press releases. We put out through Starburst Foundation, we put out like 4 or 5 press releases, and in general, I mean, because we're not like University of California or Cornell that have a incredible media connections, so whatever they put out, the media swallows, and some of it can be pretty ridiculous, like the comet theory, where they're talking about a comet that killed off the large animals at the end of the Ice Age. Some of the things they were saying in those press releases were ridiculous, but... So
perhaps, just thinking of this before, because I want to move on to, I'm looking at the clock, I want to move on to the superwave theory, but perhaps for something like, I mean, if people can start and think about your Big Bang theory, well then that's a Nobel Prize for you, which I think you greatly deserve. But if there are a lot of people listening to this call, and if each and every one of us started to get in touch with our media in our respective places, because they're all over the world, and just sort of say, you know, can get hold of some of your... are your press releases archived on your Starburst Foundation site?
Yeah, you go to, well, Starburst Found Out. They're not linked to the main webpage. You'd have to know the exact link.
Well, then maybe it's time that you got them linked, because...
Yeah, I'm trying to... If there's anyone out there that knows Drupal, I'm trying to get this thing set up in Drupal. It's like in a process of transition now.
Yeah. Well, once you get those links up, because if we, and I say we, all the people around the world who are listening, both live and on the replay, can start and get in touch with the scientific reporter for your newspaper, your television stations, or whatever, and start and get, you know, tell them what's going on. Suggest they read Genesis of the Cosmos, and read your press releases, your media releases. You know, every little drop counts, and you never know, someone might start and pick up the ball and run with it. Because this, to me, in my belief system, and I'm pretty open as far as it comes to beliefs, but, you know, I have a belief system at any one time, and I'm always open to changing it if something more appropriate comes along. But my belief system at this time is that this time on the planet, we are being exposed to all sorts of new things, and the consciousness of the world is opening up to the possibility of new things. So the time is now that if we all put our energies together and you know, seeing if we can get some information out, and all the people who are on the call, I don't know, I think most of the people who are on the call have signed up to my Raising Love Consciousness website. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be starting to send out more or regular e-zines again. I haven't done that for a while, but I will be doing that. And, you know, we might have to start a little Paul Laviolette campaign to push some of this and give some people some guidance.
But, absolutely, so that would help.
Every voice counts. Every voice counts. So let's move on, because I, you know, there are a couple of people, you know, when I read about your theory, I wanted to do something. Let's move on to your galactic superwave theory, because this is really important. And if I can just recap some of what we said in the beginning, with your system science background, looking at the big picture and that everything is interconnected, you discovered the tarot, you looked at the order, you were able to see within that a code of how the universe was formed, which took you to your genesis of the cosmos theory and your sub-quantum kinetics. Just while I think about it, your sub-quantum kinetics, how is that a subset or a subsystem of quantum physics, or is it something totally different to quantum physics?
It explains quantum phenomena, but it mm-hmm. does it in a different way. It postulates the existence of an ether, which quantum yeah. physics doesn't. Quantum physics believes in the vacuum. So there are some differences. Things like, for example, Schrodinger's wave packet. I don't know if you've heard of this. They view a particle as a wave, and the way they view it as a wave is Schrodinger's wave packet idea, which has all sorts of problems. For example, for one thing, it doesn't stay together. It dissipates, so they haven't figured out how to make it, glue it together. Subquantum kinetics predicts a wave form for the particle that actually has been verified by particle scattering experiments. So the experiments that were done actually verified completely the subquantum kinetics model of the particle, that it's a wave pattern. And that's entirely different from the Schrodinger pattern. So if you see, quantum mechanics is really based entirely on the Schrodinger idea at its basis. Right. So to make the switch to subquantum kinetics, you have to pretty much restructure entirely what you know to go to this new idea of the particle wave.
Have you written somewhere, having writing in an article or in one of your books, and I haven't seen it, the specific these differences between quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and subquantum kinetics? Have you got that written up somewhere?
Yes, it's written in my book, Subquantum Kinetics, which, for the non-technical reader, I warn you, it's technical, but not as technical as your standard physics book, but it does contain equations.
But now then, your book, Genesis of the Cosmos, is like a dumbed-down version of your subquantum
kinetics.
Right,
it's more accessible, and it shows the links to that these concepts are not only encoded in the Tarot, in the I Ching, in the Zodiac, but also in ancient creation myths like the Egyptian myth of Osiris, the Egyptian myth of Atum, the myth of Zeus, the ancient Greek myth of Zeus, how he created the universe, the story of how Atlantis was created. A lot of people don't realize that the Atlantis myth was meant metaphorically, and it's not just in the Timaeus. Timaeus talks about the flood, but the Critias, that's another book that Plato wrote, talks about the creation of Atlantis. And the metaphorical concepts there are that they're describing a subatomic particle. Atlantis is actually a subatomic particle. The wave, what you see of Atlantis with the little hill in the middle and the rings, that is a sort of magnified view brought up to our dimensions of what the field looks like inside a neutron. And it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's a way of conveying knowledge to future generations using allegory.
Well, yes, you see, I mean, just for one second, going back to the tarot, or tarot, however one wants to pronounce it, you see, the thing that I find fascinating is that scientists, and you said something I think it was Earth Under Fire, in the back section, you said you gave a talk, or you wrote a paper, or gave a talk, I think it was, and it was the greatest understatement I've ever read in my life when you said you decided to leave out the bit about the tarot and the zodiac,
right,
because it would distract the scientists from thinking. I mean, it wouldn't have distracted the scientists. They would have just thought you were raving mad.
The dean wouldn't have allowed it anyway. One time I was in his office and he wanted to know what exactly I was putting in my dissertation, and I referred to him, well, I have references from Science magazine and Nature and so on. Of course, he nodded approval. And then I started to mention the word astrology, and I could see the hair on the back of his neck start to raise. And so I didn't even go into that, but I knew I wasn't going to put it in. I just wanted to see his reaction. You know.
But the thing is, with those, we, modern scientists today, going back even to 74, have been doing the exact same thing when we, as you pointed out in your book, when we send messages out into the ether, out into space. The Arecibo message that SETI was responsible for in 1974, that was a message of diagrams, the Pioneer 10
right.
space plaque, and as
exactly.
you mentioned, a couple of others. They were pictograms. So why should we, generalization, scientists today, be able to do this, but ancient people, well, that would be rubbish because they were just fortune-telling cards. I mean, they're the sort of inconsistencies and arrogancies that really burn me up, that really make me angry.
Yeah, there's an excellent book. There's an excellent book on cross-cultural communication of this sort. Basically, that's what you have here, whether you're sending a message to another star system where they don't share the same language, or whether you're sending a time capsule message to the future where no one knows what language they'll have in the future. You want to use metaphor and concepts which both cultures will have in common. And there's a book called How Real is Real by Paul Vaslovic, who's a psychologist and psychiatrist, which is brilliant. And it talks about the basic criteria that you would need to in a message of this sort. And he discussed what he called an anti-cryptogram that is used in interstellar communication, as an example, where you put your message in a symbolic form as a puzzle or a cryptogram, and you include the key and a key and check mechanism. In other words, you give the key to decode it, and then you give a check so that the person can check whether they decoded it properly, because something will line up. And we used that technique in the Pioneer Space Plaque, and he gave that as an example. Well, it turns out the Zodiac also uses that exact same technique. That was what I had discovered. Nobody had realized that before. The keys are the Sphinx and the Tarot, and the check mechanism is embedded in the polarities and qualities associated with the signs. And when you've properly reordered the Zodiac signs to create the explanation of the physics, those line up into a certain order. It's sort of like in the Stargate. Remember when they have they're opening the Stargate and they're going first to the right and then to the left, you know, with that ring of symbols?
Yeah.
And then finally it clicks and opens. That's exactly the way it is with the Zodiac. In fact, they took that concept from my book.
Right. It just is quite amazing. Let's get on to galactic superwaves quickly. Because the other thing that came out of these codes was this concept of the galactic superwave, which you then...
Right, let me explain that. So the zodiac took me to the sky because that's where the signs are, and I realized there were these arrows, the Sagittarius arrow and the stinger of the scorpion were pointing at something. I realized that was the center of the galaxy. And the message in the zodiac was talking about this explosive outburst coming from there. And it actually gave a date, which I decoded from the arrow. If you look at where it was pointing, it wasn't pointing where the myth said it was pointing. The myth says it was pointing at the heart of the scorpion. But at a certain date in the past, it was properly aligned. And by doing calculations, you can find that date, which is 15,800 years ago or so. And so what I concluded was that there was an outburst from the galactic core on that date. And when I discovered that, I was so amazed at this discovery. I said, well, if this is true, and if this actually reached us, I had realized that this was not something far away, but this was actually a wave of energy that came and arrived on that date here on Earth. It actually impacted us. And there was symbols in the zodiac lore, in the star lore, because it involved constellations off the ecliptic, and also in a message I was deciphering. This may sound a little unbelievable, but I had deciphered a message that was being sent currently by the certain alignments of pulsars. The positions of certain pulsars are creating a message.
Yeah.
Now, whether I'm not able to convince people of that at this moment, because that would take a long explanation, but that triggered me to look at certain supernova remnants, that message, and I realized that those supernova remnants were detonated by a wave of energy coming away from the galactic center at the speed of light, and that's what allowed me to form the superwave theory. I don't go into all the zodiac lore and the extraterrestrial communication, all that, when I talk to scientists. And who cares?
Yeah, for all the obvious reasons.
How you came up with the idea, whether it was like looking into a fire and seeing circles, like the fellow who invented the benzene ring, he saw patterns in the fire flames when he was looking at a fireplace. The point is, is your theory correct? If you make a hypothesis, does it make predictions, and do they turn out correct? And so far, the superwave theory has had 14 verifications. So I'm very happy with it, and I tend to believe.
In a very, very simple, easy to understand way, tell us what your galactic superwave theory is. You mentioned that you'd been able to see that there had been some sort of ray coming to the planet nearly 16,000 years ago. Tell us what the galactic superwave is, and for that matter, what the difference is between a gamma ray, a cosmic ray, and the superwave.
Well, we're 23,000 light years from the galactic center, so it takes 23,000 years for that blast of cosmic rays to come to us. Basically, what happens is the center of our galaxy explodes. It becomes active, and its energy output jumps a million fold or so. And it radiates not light, but cosmic ray electrons and protons. And so these particles move out at the speed of light like a shell coming out. You know, shell because it turns on and then it turns off sometime later. So let's say it's a 3,000-year event that's coming towards us. That also produces on the way what's called synchrotron radiation. Magnetic fields tend to shake those cosmic rays and cause them to radiate gamma radiation, radio waves, light, and so on. And to an observer at that time on the planet, on Earth, it would have appeared like a bluish-white star, just like it says in the Hopi legends. How do we know this? Well, because we see these outbursts going on in other galaxies. In fact, a spiral galaxy like ours, they realize, spends about 15 to 20% of its time in the active, with an active core, where the core is exploding. And so we look at one galaxy, one spiral galaxy, it'll look quiescent. We look at another one, and it might have an active core. And so this is a cyclic phenomenon, and it also happens in our galaxy.
Now, is that so, much believed by the general world, scientific world?
They believe that the core explodes in our galaxy, yes. So they see the evidence of the shells and the rings and the outward motion in the core. All this I put in my thesis. By the way, I did my thesis on this. And the thing is that they believe they came. They had an error in interpreting radio galaxies and came to the conclusion that the period of this cycle of explosion and quiescence of the of these galactic cores was on the order of 100 million years. They were off by a factor of 100,000 or so. I mean, the actual cycle is about 11,000. You see 11,000 period there. You also see a 26,000-year period approximately, similar to the polar precession cycle. So they were way off, and so they assumed that the core of our own galaxy had exploded a long, long time ago, and that we didn't have anything to worry about for tens of millions of years. Now, the new results with the Chandra, they found these bubbles, have brought them closer to my position, because now they're saying, well, they came to something like, to say something like a million years ago, maybe, this outburst occurred. Now, still, they're still off by a few orders of magnitude, but it's closer than saying this was 100 million years ago. In actual fact, those bubbles were formed about, the main bubble that you see there, those two bubbles were formed about 40,000 years ago.
And you can see that picture on, after the talk, if you go to the webcast page, I've got a link to Paul's Starburst blog, and if you click on that, you'll see what he's talking about with these two, a picture of these two bubbles and a brief interview he did with the Today Show in America. Sorry, go on.
Well, actually, those bubbles are part of what's called the galactic gamma ray halo, which is a diffuse gamma ray radiation that surrounds our galaxy that was found with the gamma ray telescopes we were using. And this was announced in 97. And they couldn't understand where this was coming from because they realized it was being produced by cosmic ray electrons. But they couldn't understand where these electrons coming from because electrons producing such radiation have a very short lifetime, so they would expect it to peter out in a short time. At that time, I published some books where I said, well, this is evidence of an outburst, a recent outburst from the galactic core. I was the first scientist to say that. Nobody was saying that at that time. And now, with the new evidence with Chandra, that's exactly what they're saying when they look at these bubbles. They're saying, well, these came from the galactic core. So it's basically a confirmation of what I had said. But they still have a way to go to fully understand them, to come to the superwave theory, which totally explains what they're seeing. And it eliminates the difficulties, the conceptual difficulties they're having right now.
So do you send them a little media release or a little paper saying, look, fellas, you're confused as to what this is all about. Maybe this will explain.
I called up the lead author. He's actually a fourth-year graduate student, which is great to be lead author and have your paper published in Science, or I guess it's Astrophysical Journal. And also there's two other authors, one being a physics professor. All three, the team is from Harvard. And he was quite open to what I had to say. He was planning to read the blog and some of my papers. So I hope they'll take a look at this.
So we've got the superwave. There's an explosion in galactic center. It sends out this wave of, and I know you don't like the word energy, but this wave that we can't see, and we can't even see it coming, can we? We won't even know it's on its, it's here until it hits. Is that right?
Yeah, because it's traveling the speed of light, so we only see, when we see the light, that's when the cosmic rays are arriving. And just like in the Bible, it says about the day of the Lord arrives like a thief in the night. So that describes the superwave.
And now then,
the day of judgment.
If a mild one hit, and there's no telling whether the explosion in galactic center that will cause this superwave, whether it will be a big explosion or little explosions, it could be anything. And it would be on its way now because we're 23,000 light years away, so it has to be on its way if one's coming, right?
Right. Well, a lot of the guesswork can be taken out by looking at the record of past superwaves, which is are recorded in the ice record. You go to the poles and look at the record, let's say, from Vostok, Antarctica, Russian base. And they've studied beryllium 10. Some French scientists did detailed study of beryllium 10 in the ice core going back 150,000 years. Beryllium 10 is cosmogenic beryllium, as it's called. It's produced in the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, by cosmic rays. So the greater the cosmic ray flux, the greater the amount of beryllium 10 is going to be raining out of the sky onto the ice. And I, in fact, was predicting that they would find peaks. This is something I published in my dissertation. And sure enough, a few years later, as they got more and more data points, peaks showed up. And those basically were showing the times of arrival of past superwaves. And if you look back, you see there was a very large one 40,000 years ago that lasted something like 8,000, 7,000 years. That was huge, which I believe is associated with this gamma ray bubble they're seeing. Because if you look at the outer edge of that bubble, and it would have taken 40,000 years to get to that point.
That's interesting. So if a mild one, say, hit tomorrow, what would happen here on Earth? And can we relate something like the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami in Indonesia, which was interesting?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, the mild ones are more frequent. And there's something like, I believe, 14 mild ones have happened since the beginning of the Mayan calendar. Actually, there was one at the time of the beginning of the Mayan calendar, which is interesting, which is about 5,300 years ago. There was a superwave that was strong enough to create a small beryllium 10 spike, but wasn't strong enough to change the Earth's climate. It would definitely have shaken up people enough. But since that time, there have been 14 more, and there was an average of 500 years between these, with the last one occurring 700 years ago. And as I point out in my book, something like that could have passed unnoticed in pre-technological society. However, today it could fry satellites, knock out all our TV reception, cell phone connections, could bring down all our electrical networks. Look what happened with the solar flare that happened in 89, and it fried the transformers in Quebec, and the whole area lost power, the whole region, for a day or so. So the small ones would be devastating for a modern society in that sense. I mean, for example, if globally all the power systems went down, it would take up to 10 years to replace those transformers. So that means you'd be driving horse and buggies, because to pump gas or to even refine gas, you need electrical power.
You need electrical power for everything.
You know, you'd want to quickly go and buy a horse at that point.
In those condominiums, put them on the balcony or something. Okay, so now, but nevertheless, it would affect the communications technology and all that sort of stuff. Would it have an effect on the human, you know, on the humans on the planet as far as surviving? If a big one hit, obviously all the communications, all the electronics, satellites are going to be blown out. That's a given.
It depends on the intensity. I admittedly am projecting. We haven't been through this in modern times to record the effects for science to study it. So it requires some hypothesis here. You know, maybe who knows? Maybe one will occur where it has a minor effect on these. Mm-hmm. Satellite systems, I hope, you know, where it does show up and scientists suddenly wake up. They realize, hey, the galactic core exploded. Now we've got to realize these things can affect us. You know, right now they're asleep, entirely asleep. They do not believe that core explosions have an effect on the Earth. They don't think that those energy outbursts can reach us 23,000 light years where we are from the core. It's going to be a wake-up call when it happens.
If you hypothesize what could happen if a major one hit us, like what possibly hit the Earth 40,000 years ago?
Well, for example, it was so intense that carbon-14 levels doubled within so many thousands of years, which is pretty amazing from a geologic standpoint.
How is it going to affect the humans, the 7 billion plus humans living around the planet, other than the obvious telecommunications?
Well, for one thing, it could trigger an ice age. It would change climate. It would bring cosmic dust into the solar system, blotting out the stars. You wouldn't see the stars like you see today. You'd be in a fog.
How long would that last for?
If it was a short one, but you're talking about a long one. It could last for thousands of years. Yeah.
Right. Because I'm thinking of the Hopi and also the biblical prophecy, which talks about 3 days of darkness in conjunction with that blue light in the sky, the blue star.
Yeah.
So would that darkness, could that Hopi predicted darkness be the cosmic dust?
Yeah, that's what I believe, that you get clouds of this dust coming in, even into the inner solar system, and some of them could go between the Earth and the Sun and entirely blot out light. Also, the Sun would be accreting this. It would form a cocoon around the Sun. The Sun would become more reddish because it would be surrounded by this thick dust cloud. And we see these kinds of stars in other near us. They're called T Tauri stars. They're stars like our sun that are surrounded by dust, and they become very active. The sun would be continually flaring, not just every 11 years. It wouldn't be like just an 11-year cycle where it peaked. It would be peaking pretty much all the time and spiking up even more at the solar max. We'd be bombarded with solar storms continually. It could cause a geomagnetic flip or even a geomagnetic reversal. There was such a flip associated with the 40,000 year ago event. The event, which was fairly sizable at the end of the ice age, ended the ice age and aggravated the sun to such an extent that one of the emissions, cosmic ray events, they call them solar proton events, it was like a supersized solar flare, was intense enough to create lethal levels of radiation on the Earth's surface. I believe that's what caused the extinction of the mammoths and the saber-toothed tigers and so on.
So
I don't believe it was a comet.
So basically, if we were hit by a big one, it'd be goodnight Irene for everyone, and we could, you know, we would be another lost civilization. But if a minor one happens, it then would depend on the continuum at what level it was as to how bad and how it would affect us. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, there would always be survivors. Like, after all, the human race has survived through even the 40,000-year one. And if you study mythology, if you haven't done any reading on the myths of the ancient cataclysms, it's a good idea to read them. I have a lot in Earth Under Fire. You realize that these are actual stories. They're not made up, a lot of them. They're trying to set down what they experienced. They say, for example, about the burning of the earth. They refer usually to the sun. And they talk about how they hid in a cave, and they were putting a stick out to see, to sort of test, and it would come back burned. You know, every day they'd do this, would come back burned or charred. Finally, after the third day, it didn't come back charred, so they waited another 3 days. Finally, they go out, and everything is black. That's the thing, a solar proton event, coronal mass ejection, would have sort of parched the Earth and created forest fires that would have eliminated the food supply for large animals. You actually see the record of this in the ice core record. There's huge signature of ammonia and a smoke from forest fires at a certain date. About that same time. So the people went through a lot, but they did survive. You know, they went underground. You see even the Hopis talk about being led underground by a star in the sky.
Just as a matter of interest, I either read or heard you say somewhere, I can't remember where, that you know someone who is going to Australia because they figure that that's the safest place to be on the planet. Do you know what part of Australia they're going to?
Queensland, I believe. The middle, sort of, let's see, the southern city, what is it? I'm sorry, I don't know the geography.
No, that's
Sydney,
okay. Brisbane's
the southern
capital. Yeah, the very southern city is Melbourne of the country, but in Queensland, at the south edge of Queensland, the southern edge of Queensland is the capital of Queensland, which is Brisbane.
Okay, so you go north a bit and inland a bit, and somewhere there he is saying is safe, or going to be safe. Now, he's talking about 2012. He contact with extraterrestrials for his insight. I've heard, I've talked to a lot of different people that talk about contact with ETs, giving information that there will be an event 2012. I haven't had any contact myself, and intuitively, I tend to feel that it might go by without a superwave event happening. I have deciphered a date of 2035, 2037. From this is something that's being sent to us by the pulsar message on the one hand, and a crop circle was put down that has a coded message of 2035 as to what they're talking about. It's anyone's guess what you want to say is going to happen in 2035, but it's interesting that they encode this particular date. So
All right. Look, we're well and truly over time. Would you be able to very quickly answer a few questions that were sent in, or would you prefer not? I mean, and if you say yes, then just say, look, okay. So let's, one question is about CERN. You know, CERN, the thing in the Swiss Alps, where they're trying to recreate the Big Bang. Is it dangerous seeing as they're going to keep on upping the ante until they form matter, do you think they will eventually form matter there, and is it dangerous to us, or is it just a waste of time and money?
Now, I don't know what he means exactly by matter. I mean, they're creating particles. They're particles. They decay. So they do create matter, I mean, even now.
When the particles collide, isn't the idea to get them to collide like the Big Bang explosion, so they can start and form matter, which was the big in the traditional manner was the start of the universe?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, you know how I'm going to answer this. There was no Big Bang. Matter happens every day. I mean, even in your room, a particle is going to form if you wait long enough out of the zero point energy. The zero point energy is what nucleates matter. And that's, if you study the astronomy, you study the phenomena of the universe, what's happening, that model is what fits the data the best. It's continuous creation.
Yeah.
I could go into that in my book.
Is the Hadron Collider dangerous? Is it possible that it could blow up?
They're fearful that it might form black holes. That's baloney. You can't form black holes, period.
Yeah.
Whether it's mini or large, if you stand in the beam, it's going to be dangerous. Okay, but in my opinion, it's a big waste of money. You know, they spent $4 billion to build it. Why? To test theories that are greatly outmoded, that are incorrect. And all they're going to do is the more and more energies are going to create more and more massive unstable particles. And what are they going to learn from that? I don't think they're going to learn very much. They're basically exploring the mathematical tree of the creation of particles, of matter. You know, there's a certain mathematics underlying this creation.
That'll do. That's the sort of answer I thought you might give. Now, Dr. LaViolette, do you feel that your supergalactic wave is the white horseman in Revelation and the cross on the Masonic tracing boards? And can the wave push an ELE, asteroid meteorite, towards the Earth?
In Earth Under Fire, in the last chapter, I do discuss Revelation and the reference to the four horsemen, which I believe that there's some connections there. You can draw some parallels. You find the apocalypse, this ancient catastrophe, the cyclical event, you find it in virtually every religion discussed.
Mm.
It's one of the most important phenomena that the human race experienced, and it's preserved in our religious doctrines.
And can the wave push an ELE asteroid meteorite towards the Earth?
There is a gravitational component. So it has an effect, a gravitational tidal effect on planets. But in addition, I think that effect of moving asteroids or comets is more through the effect of the cosmic rays. What they do is they surround the solar system. They get trapped in the heliopause, the magnetic shell around the solar system, and it creates sort of a radiation belt. It's very high energy, and any comet going through there will get heated as if it's going close to the sun, and it can actually break up. And when a comet breaks up, pieces can go scattering in different directions, and some can go flying into the solar system. And indeed, in some of the art depicting, for example, Revelation, there's pictures of meteors flying through the air. So these are things that would happen. You would get this debris coming in.
Another one here. Do some of the 2012, in inverted commas, prophecies, geophysical prophecies, obviously, say that the Earth's rotation could reverse. So instead of going from east to west, the ball, which is the Earth, would start revolving round the other way. Is this physically possible, or is it not a physical possibility?
Well, I always thought that it would be impossible due to momentum until a physicist friend of mine showed me a top. He said he spun it. It was a specially shaped top. And at one point, it actually flipped over and kept spinning. And it was spinning in reverse.
But that was
I was totally amazed by it, because right there on the table, he had violated the conservation conservation momentum was violated. it's one of these things that physicists sweep under the rug and they don't discuss.
I've tried that, and if you flip it over, whilst it's true, it appears to be spinning in the opposite direction. That's only because it has been flipped over. As far as we're concerned, it's still flipping. It's still rotating. It hasn't stopped and reversed. But due to the flip of the planet, it has. It's just that the sun rises in the west instead of the east. I'll leave it at that, and we'll move on.
No.
Can intelligent life ride? Oh wait, I'll go to the one below. I think it's here. Do you think the ancients built stargates around the world based on the golden ratio to use the supergalactic waves' energy to activate their stargates, so they can avoid the layers of ash that would be atop of their heads, aka KT boundary? Does that make sense to you? The first part does.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the
second. I can only respond from my own physics viewpoint, which is subquantum kinetics.
Yeah.
Subquantum kinetics says it's impossible to form black holes. And the whole idea of stargates, that grew out of wormhole theory, the idea that you can have black holes that warp space-time and they reconnect between them at different points in space. So the whole idea of warping space-time, black holes, that I don't believe in. Subquantum kinetics replaces Einstein's general theory of relativity. It has its own explanation for gravity, which has had several confirmations, a lot more than Einstein's theory. So I have a different viewpoint on that. I don't believe that wormholes exist. And if there's stargates, if you want to redefine the concept of stargate, that it's an access to a higher dimensional realm, which actually we have access every point in space. You can access that through meditation, for example, through an out-of-body experience. Whether they've developed some technology to induce this at a certain point, that's possible. Subquantum kinetics does have certain spiritual implications for outlook of the relation between the physical and the spiritual. It opens up the possibility of higher dimensions, because to explain what's here, you have to posit a flux from a higher dimension that's maintaining it. It's the same concept that Tesla believed in for his ether.
Okay.
If you could suggest that there's a spiritual realm that's in a higher dimensional realm, and that this here is sort of like we're just these epiphenomenon, sort of the surface of the water, but the ocean is very deep, you know, and we are just the waves, and all we know are what we see as waves, but really we're waves in something, and that something is the reality which we're not aware of till we die, over.
Now quantum mechanics suggests that there are 11 other dimensions, parallel dimensions. Do you subscribe to that or not?
I wouldn't define it just 11. I believe there's an infinite number of dimensions. But
parallel dimensions?
I see it more or less sequential in some way to explain our three-dimensional experience of the universe. You at least have to posit two more dimensions that we would be, if you draw a dimension line, we are like a point on that line. And I show mm-hmm. these lines like arrows because they are really involving flux in some way. Let's say that you were now living in that higher dimensional realm. So now you have other questions like, where did this ether come from, you know, which we're just physical, so we can't answer questions like, where did the ether come from? But at that higher dimensional realm, you would probably say, well, to explain this ether, we now posit another dimension, and so on. Mm. And so the way I see it, the closest analogy is the movie Never Ending Story.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of truth in that story, I believe. You know, in that story, our minds were creating another dimension of reality, which was actually very real. And as long as we kept dreaming, as long as we didn't let our dreams die, that reality continued to exist. And I believe that's the way reality is what existence is, in the big word, existence, Maya, capital Maya, not the small mm-hmm. Maya. The Hindus were talked about, is creation in all different forms, in all infinite numbers of dimensions, things that we just can't imagine. I mean, we can't be able to grasp the extent of that, because all we can understand is in terms of what we see here, you know, and maybe we can intuit a few things about the spiritual level, but I think there's a beyond of that, you know, there's infinite dimensions. And if you want to talk about a creator, that is creation in all its forms, infinite levels. You know, and we're just such a small speck. Our whole universe is such a small speck.
Let's move on. Another one here, Stanford from Sydney. I'm familiar with Dr. LaViolette's work. Does he know of David Talbot's electric universe? It seems to me that both theories are compatible.
I don't think that David Talbot, he's a supporter of the theory, but I don't think he originated that. I think it was Thornfield.
Maybe he's written about it.
Thornfield or Thorns, a fellow actually from Australia had come up with that theory, I thought. It talks about the importance of electric fields. We have to give more importance to the effect of electric fields. For example, a lot of the craters on the moon could be, I think he was suggesting that they could be like thunderbolts hitting the surface of the moon, discharges of electric charge on planets. On the other hand, they could be coronal mass ejections from the sun. Those are sort of like thunderbolts. Those are electric charges, but they're cosmic ray charges. I believe that they could create craters just like a meteor impact could, and that's something we should look at, you know, as another way of looking at things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, a number of people have suggested that, and it's, you know, on the web and in the literature, that there's Planet X. There's a planet heading towards Earth. Do you know of this, and do you believe there's something in that?
I haven't really. I mean, people keep talking about it, and I know one guy looked for Planet X with infrared signatures, astronomer, and didn't find anything. He spent years. Now they say they have found something, and they're keeping it secret. Well, until they make it public, I can't say, you know, if it exists or not. Is there a 3,600-year cycle in the Earth's ice record? I don't see that, you know. And it's possible that such a thing could have an effect on the Earth. But I see superwaves as the main effect.
Mm.
The ones we have to worry about, I think, are the superwaves.
Have you read Dr. Alexei Dmitriev's paper about the changes to all the planets in the solar system, including our climate change, which he suggests is caused by, and I quote, highly charged material and energetic non-uniformities in interstellar space which have broken into the interplanetary area of our solar system?
Yeah, I've looked into that. Some people have called my attention to his work. I've read a little about it. The thing I'd like to bring up is astronomy has only been in existence for so many decades. And so what we see as a trend now could be a cyclic thing, could be part of the normal state of affairs. If there were, like, a super wave were really arriving, you would know it. I mean, it wouldn't be any subtle thing. And I believe it would be something would happen suddenly. Its arrival would be sudden. That's my view. You know, maybe there could be some precursor effects. I don't know.
Okay. How do you then explain the what appears to be significant and continuing increases in catastrophic geophysical events around the world, like more volcano eruptions and earthquakes and the like?
Well, subquantum kinetics predicts a connection between energy output from a planet or star and gravity potential, galactic gravity potential. So if the galaxy's gravity potential field were to vary, were to, let's say, deepen, you would get more output of geothermal energy, a tendency for more volcanic eruptions, more solar activity, sort of what's being observed. But the problem is to measure that. I don't know if there's been any programs to measure the galactic gravity potential. You'd have to look at things like the speed of light, stuff like that, see if there was changes that mm-hmm. conformed.
Okay. Now, where are we up to here? We've covered that one. Apart from the centre of Queensland, which is a couple of hundred kilometres only from where I live, because I'm in far north Queensland. So apart from that, where can people find refuge from geological disturbances? Are there other safe zones on different continents?
Well, the one in Queensland, I think that's the one that has been discussed by Payne Andov. You can find his work on the internet. Then the other group, Patrick Garrels, I think he's trying to find refuge in South Africa on a mountain.
He's in the center of South Africa. I have concerns about
actually,
his
community. Yeah, the 2012 movie, it took a lot from his book, I think. But is there going to be a 2 kilometer high wave sweep the Earth? My intuition tells me no. If such a thing happened in the past, because we're talking about cyclic phenomena, how come there's no salt water, huge salt water deposits on land? You know, all the flood deposits like of the mammoths and up in Alaska and Siberia, those are freshwater deposits, and that was water that came from the ice sheet. And indeed, torrential floods of water that could have been kilometer high or so. But I don't know of any evidence of the ocean sloshing onto the land like that.
Okay. Do you feel an asteroid, P piercing the earth would cause enough seafloor spreading to move continents apart, like when an egg cracks when it's being boiled, or in a microwave. Well, it explodes in a microwave.
Well, I'm not the person to ask that. I mean, there's people that can do simulations of that who know about planetary modeling and can model impacts. You know.
Okay.
I'm sure something like that has been shown.
Right. If two spinning tetrahedrons came together, would that form an Einstein's Rosen bridge? Do you think Mr. Holyland, will find his pot of gold? So obviously Richard Holyland. Don't know, right? Can you can you tell us about May? I think that might be meant to be May 21st. I don't know whether that's meant to be May 21st. And where the moon track will be around the Earth. Can you tell us about May 21st, 2012, and where the moon track will be around the Earth? Does that ring any bells for you?
No.
No? Okay. I think we've just about answered, you know, in both with what we were talking about earlier. No, you've covered that about black holes. Okay. I'll just read this one out from Garth. NASA, and we may have answered this, though, earlier on. NASA claims that the accretion model explains this solar mass black hole, which you don't believe in, that seems hard to reconcile with an explosive supernova creation event. How long would an accretion disk take to form in the expulsive aftermath of typical supernovae models? Is there any mechanism that can allow sufficient and immediate accretion to explain the luminosity seen? Can you explain the difference between this and the continuous wind model NASA referred to? Do you want to have a go at that, or is that all too long?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you can't form an accretion disk with outputs like that. Any gas is going to get blown the heck out of there. Just incredible wind. Plus, it would vaporize. If there was a dust particle, it would completely vaporize with that kind of cosmic ray output and radiation output. So everything is moving out. It's not moving in. If there was another star, like they talk about cannibalizing another star that was very close, like orbiting very close to it, and it would rip off its atmosphere. Okay, that might be a possibility, but there is no other star there. You know, it's just a solitary core, X-ray core. So all that energy is being generated inside the star spontaneously. Basically, our whole universe is run on genic energy, except for the larger stars that have a contribution from fusion. When a star gets as large as our sun, something like 80% or 85% is contributed by fusion. But 15% is genic. And the smaller stars, it's 100% is genic. And the smaller stars make up most of the stars in the universe. So basically, with genic energy, as soon as you admit its existence, all these phenomena, the mystery vanishes as to what's happening. It's sort of like astronomers have made it difficult for themselves by ascribing to the first law of thermodynamics so rigorously.
Right. Okay. So one last question. I'd really like to know what Paul would have to say of the notion that our solar system is due to pass through the galactic equator, that they say is like a more energetic band of space causing climatic and major geophysical events. Now, having said that, let me add that there are two theories that with the research I've done. One group of people subscribe to the theory that the solar system passed the galactic equator, the positioning of the galactic equator in the 80s. Another subscribe to the theory that we have yet to pass through the region which is equal to or side by side with the galactic equator. Do you know whether we have passed through the galactic equator region yet, or that is still to come? And would that have an effect if we...
stuff that I had read maybe 30 years ago, so, I mean, this is very long back. And as I remember from that material, it had been millions of years ago we crossed the galactic equator, not 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I believe we're going further from the galactic equator. So eventually, it's a cycle of about 15 million years or so. I guess, let's say 15 million years from now, we'll have a bird's eye view where we're looking down. We can see the whole Milky Way stretched out below us, which would be nice. It would probably be a very romantic view to see the galaxy at night that way. But we sort of bounce above and below the galactic plane. We cycle above and below. When we go through the galactic plane, there's more chance of us encountering cosmic dust clouds, dust and gas. And that's when the superwaves become more severe, because the cosmic rays from the superwave themselves are not as bad as what happens when they push dust into the solar system, because that aggravates the sun. And it's the sun that has the worst effects on the Earth. So that's why you get these cycles.
Mm-hmm. I think we've well and truly imposed on your time more than I certainly had intended. And I just thank you very much for staying the distance. Before we go, a couple of things I'd like to mention. First and foremost, I'm sure that... Paul, your Starburst Foundation still needs money to continue this important research. So yes, if you can help, or you know of some wealthy philanthropic person who can help, just go to Paul's Starburst website, and there's a link to that both on my Raising Love Consciousness website and also on the webcast page. There's a link to the Starburst Foundation. And please help in any way you can there. I'll also include those links in the replay email that I'll send out. There will be a replay that will be available, and I'll make it a downloadable replay, and that'll be up in about an hour, a couple of hours. Give me say 2 hours or so to put that up. Wait until you get an email. I will send you an email. If you haven't subscribed to get the emails from me, go to raisingloveconsciousness.com. Fill in the form at the top, and then you'll be sure to find out all of the bits and pieces we've got going. And number two is that, Paul, you have the most wonderfully fascinating lot of information and articles on your website, which is www.etheric.com. That's also on my Raising Love Consciousness website. It'll be in the replay email and on the webcast page. There will be a link to those to that site. Go and explore it. You will learn enormous things. And finally, if you want to know a lot more about what we've spoken about today, I strongly recommend that you go to Paul's website and get a look at the different books that he's written, especially Genesis of the Cosmos and Earth Under Fire. And you'll find all of the things he's written, and those ones especially are in very, very easy, plain language. You don't have to be a scientist. All you have to do is be interested in what's happening, and you'll find those listed. Well, Paul, as I said, thank you so much for the work you're doing, for the time, and in joining us today.
Thank you, Kashania. I really enjoyed being here. Thank you very much for the nice things you've said about my books.
Yes, oh, but they're great. And also, as I mentioned about halfway through the call, and I will write this up in the email and in my next newsletter, next e-zine. If we can help in any way in spreading the word to get people, especially in the media, because I spent 15 years working in the media, and once you can get through and you can get a couple of people who are interested, then that's how it spreads. And so if we can spread your message, that would be wonderful. So thanks again, and for the people on the call, thank you so much for sticking with us. You've been absolutely marvellous too. Hardly anyone has left the call, which, Paul, that shows you how interesting you've been. And so once again, Dr. Paul Laviolette, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And until next time, I'm Koshonia Carnegie, inviting you to join with me at this very special time on our planet in raising love consciousness throughout your world. Bye for now.